I'd like to thank the audiovisual crew for helping me set up and for Shiloh that filled in on the scriptures so ably. And before I forget it, we're going to have to acknowledge we've had a couple birthdays, one just recently on the 7th, one coming up tomorrow. The tenants are 94 and 91 years of age, respectively. 94 and 91 years young, I should say. Congratulations. My subject today is Luke, the 15th chapter, verses 11 through 32. And I know that this is a familiar story to all of us. I'm hoping that you'll be able to, and will be able to, have some more additional information by the time I'm through. In verses 11 through 13 in this exegesis, we are told that the younger son came to his father and asked for his portion. And when he had received it, not long after, he took it and went into a far country, and there he squandered it. It doesn't say why the young boy did this, but it should be no surprise to us, because the same thing happens today. I've noticed in my senior classes when I used to teach a couple years back that there's a certain cachet anymore about the seniors who go off away from home, far away. Whereas somebody has to say, well, I'm going to go to the junior college and then I'm going to transfer. They kind of do it almost hesitantly, almost in embarrassment. And the ones who are going far away, Oxford, MIT, Stanford, they kind of receive, not because of the places where they're going, but because of the distances they're going, a little extra attention. It, to me, in my mind, it just seems to be further away from home, further away from the rains. The Amish have a certain custom that I found out about recently reading a book. It's called Rumspringer. And in Rumspringer, when the children reach of age in their teenage years where they're asking questions about the outside world, they're allowed to go into the outside world. You see, some of them already have jobs on the outside because they're highly sought after as workers, being very assiduous. And they know about it because they've seen the cars driving by. And so they're allowed to go out and experiment freely. And now, before some of you young people are thinking, hey, where do I get my buggy license? I want you to know something. Of those who choose to do so, 75 to 80%, depending on the study you have, choose to come back to their faith. Now, that's kind of sobering when you realize what kind of an atmosphere they grew up in. Here are young people growing up without television, without the internet, without iPods. It's almost, I know, impossible for you to conceive that in this day and age, but it does happen. Sometimes they get lost, not because of what you would expect, like drugs, but simple things. Video games. They just get where they just can't get enough of them. One young man got addicted to baseball. He was a good baseball player when he was playing with his friends, his Amish friends. And he started tuning in the Cleveland Indians. And he loved the fact he could drive down the road in his car and still hear them, that he could save up enough money and go up and watch them. And that was enough to take him away. But 75 to 80% returned. In verse 13, it says that the young man wasted his inheritance. Another term for that is squandered. And the same thing again happens today. How many of you who went to college remember with great glee those care packages that you got from home? Weren't those wonderful? Because you know sometimes, some of them are up there in college and people just go through things. They go through their money. It's like the old joke, the son riding home, you know, dear dad, no mun, no fun, your son. And the father riding back, dear son, too bad, so sad, your dad. Tough love. But, you know, this happens. Well, let's go on to verses 14 through 16. And in 14 through 16, we see the sad result, the inevitable result, if you will, of what happens to the young man. He hits the nadir. He ends up in the pig pen. Today, even, Arabic countries, Jews included, have always looked upon pigs and dogs as unclean animals. And here he is at the very base. It said that he even envied the hogs what they were eating. I don't know if any of you have ever looked into a slop trough, but I'm telling you, it's not very appetizing. But this is how far down he'd gone. It says in verse 17, he came to his senses. He was reckless and riotous. Now, when you come to your senses, that automatically infers you were out of your senses. Well, what can happen to drive a person out of their senses? Well, obviously, if he's out in riotous living, you're thinking drink and drugs. Well, wait a minute, wait. Back then, yeah, they had drugs back then. Remember where the opium poppy comes from, that triangle down there in the Middle East. They had both. So he came to his senses. For a while, he was out of them. And so, in 18 and 19, he finds a lifeline. And that lifeline is to go back to his father. And it's our lifeline as well. When we get sick of sin, we always have that lifeline. Because sicknesses are sin's handmaidens. That's all they are. They're going to come with the sin. And not only social sicknesses like, let's say, drunk driving or financial cartels helping them with their business, making objects of people of the opposite sex, but we're talking physical illnesses as well, cirrhosis of the liver, addiction, STDs. So there's one lesson that we have that the young boy found out we can always return to our Father. Now, in verse 20, I'd like us to go back a little further in the chapter of 15, and there, Christ, in order to set up the people he's talking to, gives two other examples. One of these examples is the man who had lost the sheep. And it's kind of hard to work an analogy into that, but we could do it dispassionately. Maybe if one time during our youth we've lost a pet, and you know what that would be like, and then having found it again, and how you felt then, perhaps that would work. But there's also the example he gives of the woman who lost money. Now this we all should be able to identify with. We've all lost money. And it doesn't matter that that $20 bill that's lost, well, hey, there's a lot of $20 bills in the bank account. You want to find that $20 bill, and you find it, and you're happy. So now we have to take a look at what goes on when the son comes back and how the father feels. Perhaps there are some people in here that have had that happen with their children. They would be able to understand that better than anyone. But remember, this boy was off in a far country. They didn't even have snail mail. There was no way of him getting attached or getting back to his father. He couldn't communicate. There wasn't any way. There was no cell. So he was as good as dead. And now he's back. In order to help us imagine what that would be like, I'm going to refer to a story I heard from a southerner. When I first moved down here, my wife and I made friends with a colonel and his wife. And this colonel was an imbued southern gentleman. You didn't talk about the Civil War. It was the War of Northern Aggression. You get the idea? But he knew his history and his genealogy. And his great-grandfather was in the Civil War. A year before the war ended, the folks back home in East Texas didn't hear from him. They'd lost track. And after the war was over a year, the mother, the children, the slaves who had elected to stay there on the plantation were out hoeing in the field. And the colonel said that off in the distance, the mother looked up, and there on the hillside was this man leaning on a stump, had the flap of his leg pinned up to his knee. She threw down her hoe and says, "There's Pap." The kids all threw down their hoes, slaves, ran up to him. You know, I'm a northerner. One of my ancestors died in Andersonville of starvation. But I can't help but hear his words when telling that story. Getting a lump right here. Maybe that will help us to understand how that father felt. But any of us who were parents have a pretty good idea. And those of us who are parents always have heard worst thing is to lose a child before, you know, you go. I've had a friends of mine that happened to, and it was devastating. It was devastating. But maybe, again, all of this has been old news to you. So here's where I'm going to really begin the lesson. In these next dozen verses, we want to broaden our understanding to bring us to a conclusion that I hope we're going to see, and I hope we're going to be able to appreciate. Let's see if I can work this, and then perhaps... This is a portrait by Rembrandt. A couple weeks ago, Eddie gave a lesson on the sea and Jesus and his disciples. And he also did a picture on that one. And one of his acolytes came up to him afterwards and said, "Master, you've painted one too many people in the boat." He said, "No, I didn't. I'm that other person. And Christ is who keeps me from the sea of life and drowning in it." And in this one, we're going to ask to pay particular attention to the expressions on the faces here. And we're going to come back to it as we go along. In verses 25 through 28, we know that the older brother, when the younger brother came home, was out in the fields working. He just said he was out in the fields, but the implication is he was working. Remember that. He heard. He became wrathful. The father had to go to help to convince him, "Come, your brother's back." Now again, for those of you who are parents, this should be very, very familiar. I experienced it over Christmas morning. When my 4-year-old grandson and my 3-year-old great-granddaughter were arguing about the size of the pancakes they got, and the presents weren't even opened yet. I mean, parents, fill in the blank, okay? Quote, "His slash her blank is bigger, newer, better." You know, you get on and on and on. They complain about it. Well, the older brother is no different here. Let's put it into teen speak, okay, of today. What's up with this? Little brother goes out and partays down with his sketchy friends, comes home, he gets the barbecued filet, and I get the goose liver. The Braunschweiger, really? Really? You know? Yeah. It's the same thing. And it's always going to be. But remember, this is the brother that was out working. And in verse 29, and let's go through that because I want to refer to the interlinear here. "Lo, these many years do I serve thee." Serve thee in the interlinear, translated as "I slaved for you." And you see, really, that gives us an extra insight as to this guy's thoughts and attitude. "I slave for you." Not "I dutifully did it because I loved you." Not that "I did this because it was the thing to do." "I slaved for you." I think we can see another insight into his character coming up, and I'll point that out when we do. But right in this statement, "slaving for you," I told Terry at the end of his sermon this morning, I says, I couldn't got a better introduction to my sermon. Because this is exactly what I was aiming for all along. And we didn't know this together. Because the attitude. I mean, How many times have you heard Terry say here from the pulpit, the heart is the heart of the problem? The heart is the heart of the problem. And that's exactly what is lacking in this older brother. His heart was not right. Now, another giveaway is in verse 30. He complains, he says he was spending everything he had with harlots. Now, where did harlots come up before? With riotous living? That didn't entail that. Maybe we're seeing a little bit into the brother's heart what he would have spent his part of the inheritance on. Again, there's that attitude. What we do for the Lord must not be done reluctantly or under compulsion. 2 Corinthians 9:7. Our attitude is what counts. And this is Philippians 4:4. Rejoice. Be happy in our service. You know, we don't want to be told like those in Matthew 7:21 through 23, depart from me, I never knew you. But that's what it's about. Now, again, going back to the picture here. Rembrandt, one of the old masters, and W.H. Auden once wrote a poem, Musée de Beaux-Arts, where he talked about the old masters. He said, about suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How it happens on every single ordinary day. Look at this son. You say, shaven head, probably because of the lice he'd contracted. But there, eyes closed, in the bosom of his father. And there's the father. Eyes closed too. Both hands on the side. Look at the older brother. You see any love there? No, not much. You see, the brother was one of these people that keep a mental checklist. All right, now let's see. I mended the reins on the oxen. I plowed the back 40. Okay, I did my deal for the day. How many times have you been guilty of that? Okay, let's say I said grace after every meal today. I sent a card to that sick sister. I did my 12 verses, usual 12 verses a day. Well, Terry, on the 16th day of November last year, said that the kingdom of heaven does not consist of a checklist. He said it again today. I thank him for that. That's a fact of the matter, folks. Let me make this very clear to you. No one ever got to heaven by work. No one ever worked their way to heaven. Bottom line, that's it. You may not like it, you may disagree with it, but that's what the Bible tells us. Now you're saying, hold the phone. Hold there, Brother Perky. Doesn't the old song say, work till the day is over, work till the night is through? There is work to do in the kingdom, my brother. What about Romans? Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. To you I say true, true, and true. I'm not trying to diminish the part that work plays in our salvation. Because, folks, all of our life, we're going to be working. All of us, all the way to the end. But that's not going to get us into heaven. Work is a blessing. And if you've ever been without work for any length of time, you understand what I'm talking about. It's no fun to be without work. I was blind for 3.5 years. When I got my sight, God gave me my sight back. I tried to get work in a strange state with a master's degree in over 20 years. Nobody wanted to hire me. I was going back and forth between North and the States trying to find work somewhere to support my children and my wife. We found out to our horror that Texas didn't have laws like other states. You couldn't use your house for a remortgage at that time in the early 80s. And coming back one time through Kentucky in Elizabethtown, I stopped at a Hotel 6 and another fruitless visit north for work. And I didn't take my Bible into with me to study because usually they had the Gideons. So that night after my shower, I got into bed and got the Bible out. And I was studying in James at the time. And alongside the margin somebody had written, "Dear Lord, please help me get that job in New Orleans." I went down on my knees right then and there for that man, woman, boy, girl, whoever it was, that they would get that job. I've worked 48 years before I retired. I love my work. And if I can chase a little hair here, younger ones, we have two young ladies going off now, graduating, find a job you love to do. That's the key in this earthly life as far as your earthly happiness. Find a job you love. But you say, well, still, nothing new in the lesson? Okay. Well, now I'm going to perhaps illuminate you. Right now in this state, in this city, there are people who are preaching what they call the doctrine of perfection. And this doctrine states you have to be perfect before you get into heaven. And you're saying, I've never heard of the like. It's based on Matthew 5:48. Be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Folks, that's a classic example of what literature teachers call hyperbole, gross exaggeration. Exaggeration for the effect. Because in Matthew 18:9, Jesus, I'm sure, did not mean for you to cut off your arm, to reach out and pluck out your eye, if it offends you literally. It just is common sense, and it goes against what the rest of the Bible says. And I'm going to try to prove that to you as we go along here. But there are people right now who are preaching that. And as a result, what they're doing is setting people up for failure. This morning, Terry used the term learning curve, which we get a lot of in the education area. And I'm going to use one, too. It's called setting people up for failure. Now, in this case, what happens is simply this, because this happened. A couple who were visiting a place where this was preached came to me for advice. The young man wanted out altogether. He just said, Brother Perky, I can't do it. I cannot keep perfection. I try, and I just go right on back. And I spent a long time convincing him he was on the right path. Don't give up. Keep trying. You see, I could do that because I myself had that kind of spiritual thing happen when I was a very young man. I was raised in a Calvinistic doctrine. I'm not going to say which one, which particular church. But the preacher was pretty good when it came to the old H and B. You can interpret that. So I got to the point where I was prayed every night, every morning. And then, well, the preacher says that I'm going to be going to hell anyway. If I don't do right, why should I preach or why should I pray anymore for forgiveness? I know I'm going to pinch my sister Yvonne again. I know I'm going to make Cousin Penny cry just for fun. And I'll be sorry, and I ask forgiveness, and then I'll go back and do it again. No sense doing it. So I quit praying for forgiveness, and pretty soon I quit praying altogether. Well, I'm praying for this young couple. I hope that he stays with the faith and keeps going. But that's what you have when you have a kind of a doctrine like that. You will never work your way to heaven. You could take these down as we go through them. And you say, well, with such scriptures as Ephesians and Titus, how do they do it? How do they make that interpretation? Well, I asked the same question. And I was told, well, if you look at the third declension in the Koine instead of the common Greek, folks, you don't have to know Greek to understand the way to heaven. You do not have to know Greek in order to have yourself saved. But they will twist and wrest the scriptures. One of the elders at the preaching school up north where Terry Starling's father was a grandfather founded told me in the last year, anyone can make something out of anything. The Bible is like an old violin upon which many a tune can be played. But you see, the secret is you got to follow the score. You have to watch what you're doing. And what's our score? The Bible. That's what it is. And there, very clear, we're not going to work our way to heaven. It is not within man, within him, to save himself. And what better? We have time and time again, more than enough scripture to go through here. And if you want to take it down, that's fine, because eventually you're going to come across it, because that doctrine being preached is being preached to young people who are impressionable and who are going to take that out of here with them. Not out of here, thank heavens, but out of where they are. And that is a danger to their souls, a danger to your soul, danger to everybody. Jeremiah 10:23. I know that the way of man is not in himself. That's the base. That's the bottom line. And yet, you see it all the time. Alexander Pope, man is the measure of all things. It was used by Charles Krauthammer, a man I usually respect, in yesterday's editorial. Man's never been the measure of all things. God's the measure of all things and always will be. Remember that. Pride. And I think more than anything, that's what this fosters. When I debated a person who held this view, I said, have you ever heard anything called hubris? I said, it's a Greek term. It refers to people with overweening pride. It was the downfall of many a classical figure in Aeschylus and Sophocles. Well, it didn't do anything but make that particular person angrier. No, it can be done. You can be perfect. It can be done. The Bible says so. And back and forth we went. Well, we know what pride did to Satan. We know what pride can do to any of us. It can bring us down. It can drag us down. And that's what this doctrine is. He that trusteth in his own heart is a fool. But whoever walks wisely, he shall be delivered. And we just had a song, the second one Josh led, had the word humility in it. Terry talked about humility this morning. Humility. We all should strive for that. And be humble. That will contract that pride. That will go against that pride. You know, people say, well, how can they go ahead and continue and preach something like that? I often wonder, too, because, you know, it takes a convoluted mind not to understand the Bible. It is so clear, it is so completely open, not to understand it, that's the problem. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. I'm not trying to minimize the part that you must play in your own salvations. Terry opens up most of his sermons with this proviso: it is up to you to save yourself. Just like Romans said, you have the responsibility, no one else. You can't get to that sweet after a while and think, okay, everything is fine. You know, people who can think that they're going to train for heaven and learn how to play the harp here on earth, I got news for you. We're going to be working in heaven. I'm convinced of that. And I thank God that we are. There's work to do in that kingdom too. And so, without our willingness to serve with joy, to serve with the correct attitude, what's going to happen? will be like the brother, the older brother. Did he ever turn around? Did he ever come back? The point that Jesus is making is simply that. This is a time for celebration. Your brother, flesh of your flesh, is found. He's back with us. Heaven be praised. Instead of thinking selfishly. We here at Grissom Road would love to serve you in any way we can. At this time in our services, we regularly apportion a time for those of you who are visiting here so that people can let their wants, let their desires be known. We are going to stand in a few minutes and sing the hymn of opportunity. And it doesn't matter if you're a member or you're a visitor here. Is there some time that we could meet later? Is there some time you want to meet now? Is there something we can do particularly? Whatever it is, we are here to serve. Please let us do that as we stand and as we sing the song.